its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is Wednesday, the 19th of the month. Pure Michigan ads. This is a sign that summer can't be too far off, right? Pure Michigan ads have begun airing this week on national television, cable, and network. Two new ads are titled Open Road and Summer Breeze. And NBC, ABC, and CBS will all air the ads. The Associated Press says this is the first time a Michigan tourism campaign will air on network television. The state apparently is spending $13 million on its 2014 national tourism ad campaign. So disregard how it looks outside. We are going to be promoting the state for summer on national and cable TV. Its current state, we hope you can stick around. We've got the leads from Porgy and Bess, the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess at the Wharton Center. Alicia Hall Moran and Nathaniel Stampley join us in just a few minutes. And a couple of punk rock legends are in Lansing tonight. And Scott Pohl spoke with one of them, and we'll visit with Scott and hear that interview coming up later this hour. At the top of our program, the mysterious saga of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 is now in its 12th day. The flight, which took off from Kuala Lumpur, bound for Beijing, disappeared en route. Now, officials from 26 countries are searching an area about the size of the continental United States for signs of the plane. This week, current state caught up with Michigan Republican Congressman Mike Rogers, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. He told us he's receiving regular briefings on the search.
You know, I talk to the intelligence services quite a bit. We're trying to make sure that there are no terrorist nexus in the missing aircraft. Going from what is probable down to the possible and the plausible. And all of those will have to be worked. And you can't take anything off the table quite yet. We won't really, probably, until we get either some human interaction that opens up some questions for us, meaning somebody conspired to help do this, and or we get the aircraft itself, and that forensic evidence will allow us to unlock what's going on.
Congressman Rogers says the FBI and U.S. transportation officials are assisting the Malaysian government in their investigation. Its current state on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. For several years, Michigan hospitals and physicians have been implementing reforms aimed at cutting costs and improving patient care. Similar reforms are taking effect due to the Federal Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. A month ago, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan announced that 24 affiliated hospitals have agreed to launch or expand a different kind of reimbursement model. The new approach aims to link Blue Cross's repayments to hospital systems and physicians with reforms designed to improve patient outcomes. Now, previously, payments were determined by a fee-for-service model that's widely considered a factor in the soaring cost of health care. To learn more about this transformation, we welcome Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan spokesman Andy Hetzel to Current State. Andy, welcome.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So increasingly, your payments to hospitals for the care and the services that you underwrite will be more dependent on patient outcomes. This is holding hospitals and physicians more accountable than they have been in the past?
Well, what we're trying to do at Blue Cross is facilitate a movement underway in the hospital systems themselves. So this is an effort the hospitals are already working on, and Blue Cross is trying to facilitate a movement away from volume, which has really been the driver of hospital payments in the past, toward value. So hospital payments traditionally have been sort of like a grocery store checkout line. Every service performed in the hospital gets rung up and charged to the insurance company, no matter how effective it is. What leading insurance companies like Blue Cross are doing with leading hospitals are moving toward value, where we judge the effectiveness of hospital care and pay for that effectiveness in collaboration with the hospital system.
Now, your organization and many hospitals are saying this is a step forward in patient care, that it means cuts in rehospitalizations, for example, and other efficiencies. But connect the two of those for us, please. How will this reimbursement plan reduce hospitalization or rehospitalizations, for example?
Rehospitalizations are a good example of the type of value creation we are trying to enable through a different approach to payment. So In 2012, hospital readmissions, these are people who leave the hospital setting after treatment and then have to come back into the hospital for something that is an after effect of that treatment, cost about $201 million here in Michigan. If we can shave 10% off of hospital readmissions alone, what we're saving is about $20 million a year. Beyond that, we're improving the quality of life for people who leave the hospital setting after treatment. When people go into the hospital, they expect that their condition is going to improve and that once they leave, they're going to be able to resume normal functions of daily living, resume their lives, and improve their quality of life. That's what we're trying to create with these really progressive hospital systems that Blue Cross is working with across the state. We're trying to improve the quality of care, improve the quality of life, save money, and then in the end, share some of that back to the hospitals in the form of a different kind of reimbursement.
And what are some of the new guidelines and procedures here that you're moving toward? I know you're looking at infrastructure and other reforms.
Sure. So I mentioned earlier that the hospitals already know what needs to be done. They know that they need to improve their technology infrastructure, for example, to enable the hospital to share information more effectively with physicians that are outside the hospital. So, for instance, we all know the circumstance of going into the doctor's office and having a test done, and then being admitted to the hospital, and once we get there, having the same test done at the hospital. By enabling doctors and hospitals to share information better, creating all patient registries, for example, we can eliminate the need to do that second test and save the money and treat the patient in the hospital system much more efficiently. And by eliminating that cost and sharing the savings back to the hospital, what Blue Cross is trying to do is to enable more efficient care, higher quality of care, savings, and a different form of reimbursement that really gives these hospitals the infrastructure funding they need to make these changes.
But ultimately, Andy, there is the risk that Blue Cross Blue Shield might withhold a payment if certain guidelines and procedures aren't followed by hospitals and physicians?
That's really not the approach. The approach isn't a punitive approach. The approach is collaborative, and it's designed to enhance what the hospital systems are already doing to build the infrastructure necessary to collaborate with doctors, to share information electronically, to build better care management processes. And we recognize that in doing these things, the hospitals will have less patient volume. And in the past, volume has been the driver of hospital reimbursement. We've seen that fail in the past. Healthcare costs have exploded exponentially. Hospital costs account for about half of all healthcare costs. We're trying to work with the hospitals collaboratively to build better systems and save money and then share the savings back to the hospital in a different way.
How might patients served by Blue Cross Blue Shield doctor's office or hospital notice this change during a doctor's visit, let's say? Is there something basic in their doctor's visits that they're apt to experience that's new?
They're already experiencing that. What the Blues have done is, over the past few years, we have built the largest patient-centered medical home program in the country right here in Michigan in collaboration with primary care physicians, and patients are already seeing the difference. Medical home physicians are being much more proactive. They're using electronic prescribing. Their offices are staffed with nutritionists and other people who reach out to manage patient wellness, not just treat sickness. And what we're doing is we're realizing the success of that program in dollar savings. We are transferring that success into the hospital system to enable that type of approach to be successful in hospitals, where hospitals, doctors, and patients are working together in an ecosystem that is more patient-friendly and focused on better patient outcomes. And we're rewarding that through changes in reimbursement that share savings back to hospitals and allow them to build the infrastructure necessary to make these types of improvements.
And is the Affordable Care Act related to these reforms?
It is. The Affordable Care Act incentivizes hospital systems, for instance, to build what are called accountable care organizations, which are exactly what I've been describing to you, where the hospital, the affiliated doctor practices, work in close collaboration to manage every patient from a population health management standpoint. That means what they're looking at is the total quality of care provided to the population that is serviced by that hospital to improve the metrics and outcomes for that population and realize savings. The Affordable Care Act incentivizes it. Medicare has made reimbursement changes to incentivize it. And Blue Cross, which covers 4.4 million people in the state, are working with hospitals to make these changes real in Michigan.
We're talking with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan spokesman Andy Hetzel about Blue Cross Blue Shield's new reimbursement model that involves a growing number of Michigan hospitals and physicians. I understand there are deadlines involved. What role do those play?
Well, what we're trying to do with each hospital is when their contract comes up for renewal, we're trying to work with them proactively to help structure this different type of reimbursement approach leading into the next contract. Currently, Blue Cross has worked successfully with CHE Trinity Health down in Southeast Michigan, with St. John Providence Health System, with Beaumont Health System, with Munson Healthcare, with Mid-Michigan Healthcare, with a system up in Traverse City. We have about one-third of the hospitals in Michigan currently engaged with us on this type of reimbursement approach. And these hospital systems have demonstrated that they're committed to better population health management. They're committed to building the new infrastructure necessary to do it, and they're working collaboratively with us to change the game, change the paradigm in Michigan away from fee-for-service, paying for things that don't necessarily work, toward value. And we salute these hospitals and others who are currently talking with us about making these changes. It's making Michigan a national leader in this type of approach.
Well, if the new reimbursement system is labeled value-based, a cynic might have doubts about the previous system, wouldn't they? I mean, what would you say to a person who asked, hey, what should reimbursement be based on if not value?
Well, I think that
how did we get to the point where we became such a volume-based system?
Well, that's just been the traditional approach, but every ounce of data that's available over the last 30 years of healthcare points to that approach as being a failure. In 1999, family coverage for health insurance cost about $5,700. In 2012, it was off the charts more than $15,000. That's 20 years of evidence that points to the need to change how we've been paying for services. And we recognize, everyone recognizes, that for a long time we've been paying for services that are not effective. We've been paying for redundant care, and we have a problem with such things as hospital readmissions that are driving up healthcare costs. The government recognizes it, hospitals recognizes it, and insurers recognize it. What we're trying to do is collaborate together and change that paradigm and share in the outcome. So as we achieve savings, Blue Cross's approach is to share some of that value back to the hospital to enable them to continue this good work.
Okay, well, a very interesting trend here that we're hearing about. We want to thank Andy Hetzel, spokesman for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, about the way that health insurers are changing their reimbursement models for Michigan health care providers. Andy, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Tony Award for Best Broadway Musical Revival back in 2012 went to the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess. And the company touring the country with Porgy and Bess is in East Lansing this week for 8 performances at MSU's Wharton Center. We're delighted to have the actors portraying Porgy and Bess with us on Current State today. Porgy, Nathaniel Stampley, welcome to East Lansing.
Good morning.
And Bess is Alicia Hall Moran.
Hello.
Welcome. It's great to see you both, and we're glad you could join us here today. This production is described as not being the opera, but rather a staging in the more traditional musical theater format. What does that mean in terms of the audience experience?
Well, I think if you're familiar with the opera, you're going to come to this particular production and you're going to notice that there's a lot more dialogue than previously were sung through the whole time in the opera. But in this production, we have, you know, actual book scenes in the show. But the value of having the wonderful songs from the show are all still there. Mm-hmm. So I Got Plenty of Nuttin', It Ain't Necessarily So, Summertime, mm-hmm. all the great songs that you know about Porgy and Bess are in the production.
Explain the story to people, though, who've never seen a production of Porgy and Bess.
Well, pardon, you're getting my morning diva voice, which will wake up in 4 hours.
We would expect nothing else.
Well, you know, Bess is a woman who has a drug addiction and a love of the attention of men, needs comfort and support in the world. Mm-hmm. And Porgy is, in the 1935 word, a cripple. And he has this physical affliction, but he loves, sets his sights on Bess. And when Bess's big boyfriend, well, murders someone, Bess is left on her own in the town, and Porgy really takes her in when no one else will. Mm-hmm. And they have a love that emerges from their kind of her bottom feeding and his really kind of, I think, high-minded ideals about the, you know, possibilities for humanity. What do you think?
Is that your take on it, Nathaniel?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the, you know, the core of the story, it's a love story. And it's the kind of love that, you know, many of us have experienced that will absolutely change your life. And so, you know, all of the characters from the beginning of the show to the end, they are not the same. We see them change. And it's purely through the power of love. And we get to hear wonderful music of George Gershwin's and, you know, wonderful dancing and great costumes, but just overall a great night of theater.
What's your favorite moment in the performance, Alicia?
Well, I think it's part of the genius of our director, Diane Paulus, that she somehow orchestrated for what is really traditionally an opera, some really wonderful musical theater what would you call these, devices. So there's a moment when the entire ensemble, as in like a chorus line, turns around, faces the audience, and sings the most beautiful chorale by the water. And I think probably that's my favorite moment. But I also like to sing with Nate. We have a beautiful duet or two. And I usually, by the end of each, have some emotional reaction that surprises me and surpasses my...
Every performance?
Every single one. Because, you know, when you're singing, you could just stress one word over another word one night, and it will bring you dramatically to an entirely different place. So some nights I feel at the end of I Loves You, Porgy, you know, that if I let him go, I will fall off the end of the earth. Mm. Sometimes that's because I have to leap onto his lap, and if the chair feels rickety, we might really go over. But, you know, you're really clinging to this man. And then other nights, my own feeling about Bess, and she's so road weary, and her legs are weak, her body's weak. She's just got nothing, and she's at the bottom, you know, the pit of an addiction. She's just at she's hit bottom, mm-hmm. and he still will hold her. The only person in the world who will have her whole at that moment.
What a gift, though,
you know?
to be in a play, to be in a production that you can alter in, or are all productions like that? I mean, do you play with the dialogue in the way that you just mentioned in other productions as well that makes it feel different, that keeps it fresh?
The skills I've learned in other productions... I bring them all to bear in this piece. This mm-hmm. piece has this magical ability to contain everything I've learned as a classical musician, everything I've learned singing jazz with a microphone in front of a small club audience. I can bring everything I know to this piece, and that's just not even appropriate somewhere else. I'm not going to bring what I know about Duke Ellington to much Mozart. but the Gershwin can take it. That's my answer.
How much did you know about Porgy and Bess, Nathaniel, before you landed the roles on Broadway?
Quite a bit. When I was in high school, I was in the opera chorus. I grew up in Milwaukee, and I was in the chorus of the full-length opera when I was in high school. And I knew that score inside and out. It's definitely as a teenager, you know, you learn everyone's lines, all the musical, you know, even when you're not around, you're just absorbing everything.
Alicia, what about you? When did you first become aware of it? You
knew the music. Yeah. And the story, you know, African-American people, I mean, I'm just so attached to the artists who have been attached to that piece. Sammy Davis, Leontine Price. So it just kind of comes up. And my voice teacher at Manhattan School of Music, Adele Addison, was the voice of Dorothy Dandridge in the film.
Mm. Oh, how interesting.
Yes. And, you know, she never really would talk about it, actually. So Porgy and Bess is kind of a tucked away experience for many people. And it kind of is funny, you know, don't you find it comes out in a conversation when they say, oh, yeah, my mom used to play those songs for us all the time in the kitchen. Or, oh, yeah, you know, my grandfather was one of the first, did it in, you know, knew the guy who did it. You know, it's kind of like a thing that a lot of people have a very faint attachment to, especially in our community.
Well, the different generations have really, you know, it just keeps evolving, really, in the way that the story is treated and in the way that it's presented. Let's talk a little bit about the historical significance here. I mean, the integration of audiences in the 1930s. What was significant here in the evolution of this thing?
Well, In the 30s, they were on, you know, the show premiered in 1935 at the Colonial Theater in Boston. And a few years later, they took the show on the road. Well, one of the stops was at the National Theater in D.C. And Todd Duncan and Anne Brown, the original Porgy and Bess, they refused to perform because the house wasn't integrated. And, you know, they got a lot of heat from producers and presenters, but eventually, you know, the presenters had to give in, and it was the first time the National Theater was integrated. So, I mean, it's a wonderful history of just wonderful artists touching and gracing this piece, but also, like, the piece touching lives of many, many people, not just in the U.S., but around the world. But you're telling this incredible story from a tiny community in South Carolina,
right
in Charleston,
Gullah Island.
Yeah, exactly. But it's told in a way that it's a universal love story,
and it's amazing to consider in 2014. But I mean, there were all white presentations of Porgy and Bess at one point in time. I mean, to illustrate how far we have gone with this, and how it really reflects everything else that's going on in this country.
We did bring the tour to National Theater. We were invited to perform it there. It's a beautiful week for the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I remember someone asking me, how did it feel to be in this iconic piece and this really kind of contentious bit of history with it at the National Theater? And I remember, I just thought that I was so proud of the current management there, the executive decision to bring the piece in. You know, people really don't have to opt in to face their own segregated past, and they did it beautifully. I just thought, you know, that's what's changed.
You really have to be what they call a triple threat in this production, though. Here, you got to be able to sing and dance and act. Does it challenge you particularly in that way? I mean, I mean, not everybody is cut out for a role in this production.
Yes, that's very true. I think, you know, in a production like this, where, you know, you're working with a award-winning Broadway director, you know, and Diane Paulus, she has a certain aesthetic that, you know, will challenge any artist on the stage. And so her thing is about presenting truth all the time. And so your truth, you know, needs to be in your movement. It needs to be in your voice. It also needs to be in and everything that you do and how you walk and smell and communicate with everyone on stage. So I think that in itself is the challenge. And audiences nowadays, you know, you can't just park and bark anymore as they do in some operas. Like, you want to see a full package of someone living in this community. You know, you can't just be a pretty face and you can't sing or can't dance, but, you know, you look great. Those days are over, I believe. You know, audiences demand more, and we demand more of ourselves as artists.
My wife attended last night's performance, and we were up way too late talking about this thing, and we got up this morning, and we're still talking about. She's telling me all about it, but she was really struck by how engaged the audience is during this. Do you detect that? Do you detect various levels of engagement when you're performing? I take it you must.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we get a chance to do this show 8 times a week. And as Alicia was alluding to, there is no one show that is the same. So, you know, if she has a different inflection in her voice or an audience will respond to a laugh that we didn't know was there, or, you know, every house is different. Every performance is different. But what's moving for us is that, you know, I always like to say what's great about live theater is that it truly is a communal experience. So for a silent moment to exist, we all have to be in agreement, not just the performers on stage, but including the crew, the ushers out front, and even the audience. So for that silent moment to truly exist, we all have to be in agreement for us to enjoy what live theater truly can be, which is, you know, just beyond just, you know, normal pedestrian living. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there are many nights where I'm just chilled by a silent audience because you know, you sort of have them in the palm of your hand.
That's great. This has been very special. We want to thank our guests Nathaniel Stampley and Alicia Hall Moran. They portray Porgy and Bess in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess through Sunday at the Wharton Center. Many thanks.
We'll see you there.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. It is Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature two services from the Capital Area United Way, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. It is that time of year, of course, and their 211 support line. Here to tell us more is Teresa Kometz, president of the Capital Area United Way. Nice to see you, Teresa.
Nice to see you, Mark.
And joining her is Tiffany Lemieux McKissick, director of the Asset Independence Coalition. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. Teresa, how does it work?
Well, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program is a program of the Asset Independence Coalition and Central Michigan 211, which is a United Way funded, United Way program, is instrumental in helping to schedule the program. But really, Tiffany can tell you a lot about the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. So I'm just going to have Tiffany go ahead and share that.
Go for it.
I would love to. So if you make under $53,000 a year, regardless of family size, we'll do your taxes absolutely for free. That's state, federal, and city. And we operate 26 sites. Some of them are virtual, but about 16 are in person in the mid-Michigan area. And we've been doing the VITA program for 10 years. It's entirely volunteer operated. So volunteers come with us, we train them, they're IRS certified, and we have a really strict quality review process. So a lot of times we're much more accurate, we get you more refund, a larger refund than paid preparers. Mm.
53 grand is a little more than I was expecting, to tell you the truth. How is that possible?
Well, it's 53. The IRS sets those limits, and really it's because we are targeting not just low income but also moderate income to make sure that we can get the largest refund possible, because it's a huge stimulus for the economy. Obviously, tax time and getting that refund is, and the earned income credit. So we make that income. We don't set that. The IRS sets that income cap for us.
Any other restrictions, Tiffany? I mean, for example, are there certain types of tax forms that you don't assist with?
Yeah, you know what? We actually do almost everything. There's some smaller things, like we won't do business use of home. We won't do a couple other smaller things. But really, you should call 211 and make an appointment, and then we can go through that with you. The 211 operators are trained to go through. But really, just about everything is that you can imagine in that income range is in the scope of our program.
That's encouraging. These are one-on-one, in-person meetings, which sounds like you need quite a few volunteers who know how to do taxes. How does that work?
So we recruit every year. We have about 200 volunteers in our program, about half of which are actually MSU accounting students. We have a pretty robust partnership with MSU, but we have partnerships with Olivet College, even Northern Michigan College. We're doing virtual VITA with Marquette this year, which is pretty cool. And then about half of our volunteers are just concerned community members who really care about making their community a better place.
That is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Teresa, tell us more about the 211 service. What's available through 211?
Sure. 211 is a free-to-the-end-user service. So there's no cost for someone who wants to dial 211 from a cell phone or a landline. And it enables them to be connected with a case management specialist, someone who will listen to what their presenting concerns are and help them think through what health and human service opportunities are available to them. Often, Mark, someone may call in and say, I'm interested in finding out, getting assistance with my electric bill. And then there are some regulations from the Department of Human Services. So we may not be able to help them with what they call about originally, but our call specialists take the time to walk this individual through, this caller through, what is going on in their world, and to help connect them to services. Maybe services, if you're having problems paying your bills and you don't have a shutoff notice for your utilities, our call specialist would say, well, what else are you paying? What else do you spend your dollars on? Oh, well, we need prescriptions. Okay, well, we can hook you up with prescription assistance. Or we can hook you up with volunteer income tax assistance. So 211 is really a place for someone who wants to give or get help to call. They look at a broad spectrum of needs from that caller to make sure that they get to the root cause of what's going on in that person's life and gets them connected to services in this community.
What role did 211 play in the ice storm over the holidays?
It's a great question. Our call volume spiked during the holidays, particularly in the Lansing community. And our call specialist, that happened on a weekend and an evening, and we're a 24/7, 365 operation. And so our call specialist helped to connect individuals to warming centers. They made sure that if someone was in need of finding food, that they could connect them to food pantries. So we did over 100% of calls on that week.
Amazing.
Over from a previous year.
Tiffany, tell us more about the Asset Independence Coalition. What is your organization's mission?
Sure. So the Asset Independence Coalition is a coalition of about 50 different financial institutions, nonprofit, community members, and partners. And basically, we all came together 10 years ago, a group of people did, and realized that the key to a healthy community is really a financially stable community, and that it starts with helping families gain greater financial security. So that's our mission and that's our goal. And
this is a Lansing-based organization?
It is Lansing.
Mid-Michigan regional?
We're physically based in Lansing, but our territory is Mid-Michigan, so we have we serve Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties.
Okay. What other services do you provide?
So VITA is our largest program, but we also have Bank On Mid-Michigan. So that helps people connect to bank accounts who have had trouble in the past. So say you bounce a check when you're 19 and then you're in the check systems system and you can't get a bank account. And what we find is that people that don't have bank accounts spend an average of about $1,000 a year on check cashing alone. And that's not even discussing the predatory things that you get in touch with in that situation. So we help people get bank accounts, and we make sure that it's a product that's fair and reasonable, and we have several different financial institution partners. So those are two things that we do. We also bring together and leverage our partnerships for financial counseling and services and make sure that the community can connect to everything available in the financial services realm in mid-Michigan.
And if we've got a listener who wants to get involved and perhaps volunteer, how do they do that?
They can call 211. So 211 can connect them not only to VITA, but to BankOn, connect them to the volunteer opportunities, and can connect them to us in general. And they can also visit our website, which is michiganfreetaxes.org.
And what about United Way, Teresa?
Sure, absolutely. Those folks who are interested in volunteering and or donating can go to our website, micauw.org. and or call 211 if they need to be connected to resources.
Teresa Kometz is the president of the Capital Area United Way, and Tiffany Lemieux McKissick is with the Asset Independence Coalition. Good luck. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Current State could always use more nominations for our Neighbors in Action segment. We know there are people in orgs out there doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Two legends of punk rock will be in Lansing for a concert tonight, but rather than screaming electric guitars, the show will be acoustic. And Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on the Punk Goes Acoustic tour of Glenn Matlock and Sylvain Sylvain. Hi, Scott.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm great.
You were heavily into punk rock back in the 70s,
well,
right?
There was no missing it.
Safety pin through the cheek, all of that.
I had a different look back then. That's right. I was never a big fan, but there was no missing it as kind of a, I mean, it impacted the musical landscape hugely. Yeah.
Well, the Punk Goes Acoustic tour features Sylvain Sylvain, who played guitar in the New York Dolls, and Glenn Matlock, who was the original bassist in the Sex Pistols before the infamous Sid Vicious. Sylvain and Matlock will be at the Loft in Lansing tonight, and people are combining the names of their former bands and calling them the Sex Dolls. I talked with Glenn Matlock last week. I'm going to apologize. We had a really awful phone line. You might want to turn up your radio just like you might turn up a punk rock record as you listen to this, and listen very carefully. He wrote much of the Nevermind the Bollocks Sex Pistols album, including the song Pretty Vacant. Let's start with a Sex Pistols performance on the David Letterman show of Pretty Vacant, with Glenn Matlock on bass and background vocals, and then his acoustic version of the same punk rock classic. How long have you known Sylvain Sylvain?
I've known Sylvain since about 1974, 75. Not very well, but there was talk about him originally coming over to England and possibly being another guitarist in the Sex Pistols. It never worked out, but, you know, there's a history there between Malcolm McLaren, who managed the Pistols, who worked with the New York Dolls, and a contact was established. And we run into each other over the years with various different projects. And he's just a nice, good, tough guy, you know.
The Punk Goes Acoustic tour, I want to know more about it. I've looked at some YouTube video clips, and it seems to be just the two of you with acoustic guitars, and I want to make sure that that's right. Are you playing with any other musicians on this tour?
No, it's just a guitarist, it's the songs that down to their basics. See, the thing is, all the songs that we play are actually written on acoustic guitars in our bedrooms, in our living rooms and stuff. You know, there's a spirit involved, and I like to think, and people seem to pick up on the fact that you can hear the lyrics a lot kind of clearer. Yeah, it's just back to the basics. I like doing acoustic things. Is all you do, you just turn up, get your guitar out the case, and sort of check that it's sort of in tune enough to rock and roll, and start playing. It's very immediate. You just get up and go. To me, music should be simple.
When you play with Sylvain, are there Sex Pistols songs? Are there New York Dolls songs? Other covers?
Yeah.
New original material, maybe?
There's a bit of everything. The beauty of doing what I do, and I think what Syl feels as well, is that we can do songs from every aspect of our career. We know pretty much all of them because we're the guys who wrote them, and we're not dependent upon the rest of the band knowing them. And we can just do a song. If somebody calls out for a song and it kind of fits the mood, we'll do it. You know, so we can chop and change just like that. And it's a really good way of kind of getting to work with the audience and getting them involved in what you're doing. It's very audience participatory. It's a good vibe. You know, I don't know that YouTube is possibly gives the best, the best take on it. You've got to be there. But it's a fun night as well. I'm not trying to ram all my like stuff down people's throats. If I go and see David Bowie and he doesn't do Ziggy Stardust or Heroes, I will go home disappointed. So I will do that with the audience. You know, I know they want to hear certain songs, but I'm not going to tell you which ones I do because then there'll be no surprise.
Well, then I shouldn't ask you about Bang a Gong because there were quite a few video clips of the two of you playing that on YouTube.
Yeah, well, maybe that's one we do at the end for a laugh, you know.
How are audiences responding?
Been going down very well. You know, we've done about 8 gigs so far on this tour of 25, 26 shows, and it's been good. It's been good, and it's not the first time that we've done this. We did a tour about the same time last year. We didn't come to Michigan last time, but we are this time. So the word's slowly spreading. And it's not the only thing that we do. We still do other different projects. I mean, I was actually in Japan in late January, early February, doing something. Some Japanese guys over there. I'm going to be recording a new record soonish, so I've been writing for that. We all get around, and I know Michelle's doing things. He's got some radio show that he does. Bit of this, bit of that is what makes life interesting.
I understand you have a couple of sons who are musicians too.
Yes, my older son Sam is in a band called Dead. They had Record of the Week on the rock show on Radio 1 in England just before Christmas, and they're out about touring. His band's called Dead, and my younger son's at music college at the moment. He's trying to get his band together. Yeah, but I'm proud of them. I've tried heavily to dissuade them because I don't need the competition, but they seem to want to do it anyway.
I have one last question after talking with you for a few minutes here, having a nice, pleasant conversation. Considering your punk rock roots, are people surprised to find that you and people like Sylvain are really nice people, that you're not swearing and spitting on the floor and breaking things? Do people get surprised by that?
They kind of. I think most punk rockers were pretty kind of cool, really. You know, neither of us suffer fools gladly, but you seem like an all right guy to me, so there's no reason to throw things at you or swear at the moment.
Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
All right, fella. Thanks for having us on. And yeah, come on down to the show.
I'd like to do that. It'll be a lot of fun. Glenn Matlock performs on Wednesday night with Sylvain. They're bringing their Punk Goes Acoustic tour to the Loft in Lansing. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Since 2009, the Capital Area College Access Network has helped hundreds of students from the Lansing School District with college readiness skills and support. The network is now looking to expand throughout all schools in Ingham County. And here to tell us more about the program and the expansion is Cheryl Timms, the coordinator for the Capital Area College Access Network. Welcome, Cheryl.
Good morning, and thank you.
Sure. Tell us about, it's CAN, right?
Yes.
College Access Network. CAN, when did it start?
Well, the College Access Network actually started in 2009, and it started as a pilot so that we were supporting the Lansing School District High Schools with unique programs to help increase the college attainment rate for all of the schools in the three high schools in Lansing.
Was a particular need detected there by the organizers?
Well, yes, there is a need throughout the entire state as well as the entire country that we need to have at least 60% of the residents attain a post-secondary, i.e. after high school, degree or valuable certification by 2025. And that's because there will be so many jobs that will require higher education by 2025 that there will be maybe 2 million jobs that we won't have people to fill because they won't have the skill sets. Mm-hmm. So within the state of Michigan, we have over 50 networks that are collectively working together to increase that number of college attainment, being a degree, be it undergraduate degree, be it associate's degree, or a valuable certification, because at the rate that we're going, by 2025, if we don't have this special attention, we'll only be at 43%, and we need to be at 60.
Mm. What services do you offer?
Well, we currently have some major events that we sponsor in all of the schools that we support, and first one comes is College Application Week. We want every student to complete a college application during that week, and that's early in November. And right now we are close to about 75% of our students that have completed at least one. Several, of course, have completed more than one.
All students to complete a college application.
All students.
Even if they're not thinking about attending college.
We want them to either complete a college application or like a technical school application. So not just like a community college or a four-year college, but they're also technical schools. So we count those as applications as well, because it's not just college, it's career.
Okay.
So that's one event that we focus on totally for an entire week in November.
And you're in the process of expanding as well.
Yes.
To all schools in Ingham County. How are you undertaking that?
Well, right now we are looking at the graduation rates. We're looking at where the greatest opportunities are to have more students apply for college, more students complete applications for federal student aid. So we are actually prioritizing how we roll out through the Ingham Intermediate School District schools based upon where the greatest need is.
Okay. You're planning on developing what are called asset maps that
yes.
will help young people find resources in the community. What is an asset map, and what will it do?
An asset map is a collection of resources in every community that can help a family identify programs, be it after school or in school, that are in place to help with maybe ACT prep, to help with tutoring, to help with college readiness, to help with financial aid. It's a conglomerate of data that a family, a community, a student can look at to say, I really need to have, for example, some assistance with my math so that I can get a better score on my ACT. Looking at an asset map, which would be in the form of a brochure, a family can say, well, here's something that's going on real close. Maybe it's at the Boys and Girls Club down the street.
Mm.
Or maybe we want to visit some colleges. Who's providing college tours?
Are there more resources out there than people think?
Absolutely.
You're just kind of collecting all
Absolutely.
Of them and getting them in front of people's faces.
Absolutely.
Okay. How do you work with other college readiness programs in the area? We got Lansing Promise and Hope Scholars both come to mind.
We work very closely together, because we are all working to provide all of our students with the greatest opportunity to have a more successful and, of course, quality of life. So with the Lansing Promise and with the Hope Scholars, we work collectively because our focus is college attainment. So for us on readiness, we may do a workshop with the Hope Scholars at their annual dinner to help the students, even though they may be middle school students, to say, well, I have a career interest in, let's say, journalism. So to help them identify early what classes they need to take in school, what are going to be the requirements to achieve that career. With the Lansing Promise, they have plans in place to improve readiness, and let's say with the scholarships that the students are guaranteed, we want to make sure that those dollars are used to achieve real college credits, so that they're not taking classes that maybe they needed to do better at in high school.
Oh, okay.
So we're working together to see where we can add the greatest value collectively.
How has CAN been doing since 09?
Well, we have increased the number of students that are completing the free applications for federal student aids. That number is growing every year. We're definitely, responsible for over $2.5 million in Pell Grants, because there is a major focus on completing those applications. We also have more students that are looking at applying for scholarships. We do workshops on essay writing. We're completing workshops on creating those scholarship profiles. We are working with a large variety of other business and community leaders to make sure that we've got the right people at the table to help us implement programs that will help the students be successful, and as you mentioned earlier, throughout all of the intermediate school district schools.
I think you may have wanted to tell me about another event you have coming up. What is there another one?
Well, coming up in May, Decision Day. Decision Day is another one of, we call them like our core events. So Decision Day is almost like the last core event of the school year, where we want every high school senior to have made a decision and to have received their letter of acceptance, at least from one college, one university, or one technical school. And then we want to have a big party to celebrate it at each school that we accomplished that goal.
What a commendable goal. We want to thank you for joining us today. Cheryl Timms is the coordinator for the Capital Area College Access Network, CAN, which is expanding its college readiness services to schools throughout Ingham County. Cheryl, thanks for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. We hope you can join us tomorrow. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Have a great day.